For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, looks like I'm teaching in the evening again. I feel like the order of the universe is back in its place instead of doing my morning sessions. I want to encourage you, if you are looking for a new devotional study, to maybe think about going through the Psalms. I did this this winter, and I found that God really spoke to me in a lot of ways through the Psalms, and really, I think, deepened my life, my inner life with God. So anyway, I want to share a few thoughts from Psalm 139, famous psalm, that most think are from King David. And I entitled this God's Active Presence. David begins in verse 1 by saying, oh, well, first of all, I want to lay out my 3 points here just to give us an outline of where we're going here. I think Psalm 139 can be dissected into 3 sections. The first is God's presence is an inescapable fact. Secondly, God's presence represents a radical threat. And thirdly, God's presence pushes us to the brink of either flight or intimacy. So why don't we take down the first point? God's presence is an inescapable fact. Verse 1 says, O Lord, you have examined my heart and you know everything about me. This verse really represents David's thesis for the rest of the psalm. And I think what he's trying to do is he's trying to get us to envision a doctor giving a patient a thorough examination, or a friend who is prodding and probing you and eventually gets you to spill what's in your heart. And so what he's talking about here isn't just facts. He's not describing factual information about us, but he's talking about the kind of knowledge that comes from real intimacy with him. Verse 2 clarifies this a little bit more. We're told, you know when I sit down or when I stand up. You know my thoughts even when I'm far away. And so God's understanding of us is vast. He knows when we sit down and when we stand up. He knows our very thoughts. I think that the New Living Translation doesn't really capture the heart of what this verse is trying to communicate. I think the New English Translation puts it a little bit better, where it says, even from far away, you understand my motives. And I think that's interesting because on the one hand, when we talk about God knowing us, it brings about this sense of awe and wonder that God understands us, that he knows every detail about us. And yet, on the other hand, it's a little bit scary because he knows our motives. He knows the things that drive us. You know, on the one hand, he knows when we are doing things out of a genuine and sincere heart to serve him, but he also knows when we're doing things out of a selfish motive. He knows when we're trying to glorify ourselves, even though we try to mask that under a thin veil of humility. He says in verse 3, you see me when I travel and when I rest at home. You know everything that I do. So he describes how God's eye is upon us from the moment that we wake up to the moment that we go to bed and lay our heads down to sleep. He watches us throughout the day. He sees everything that we do. And so it's amazing that God follows us throughout the day, that he's concerned about every little detail about our life. Whether we're feeling sick that day or whether we had pastrami and rye. You know, he concerns himself with the most minute details of our life. Yet he says, you know everything that I do. Everything. Think about that. It's a little scary. Everything? Well, in verse 4, he says, you know what I'm going to say even before I say it, Lord. So as we're forming a thought in our head, God already knows what's going to come off of our lips before we even say it. So on the one hand, He knows when we say things behind closed doors where we're encouraging a stuck believer in our home church. He knows when we are saying things that praise somebody that we view typically as a rival. And yet on the other hand, He knows when we are reviling people in order to leave a mark on their reputation. He knows when we tell a lurid story in order to get a rise out of people or just to get people to laugh for entertainment value. He knows how we talk to our spouse or our children behind closed doors that otherwise, if we did in public, would embarrass us. He knows all of those things. In verse 5 and 6, He says, "You go before me and you follow me. You place your hand of blessing on my head. Such knowledge is really too wonderful for me, too great for me to understand." So like a father, He goes before us and at times is behind us, leading us. Sort of reminds me of times when I'm walking with my son through Target. You know, on the one hand, I'm either walking in front of him as he's crying, begging me to buy something for him, and I'm just pretending to ignore him. Or I'm behind him with my hand on his head, steering him past the toy aisle to get to the aisle that I want to get to. And so likewise, God does that he guides us. And David is, this thought of God's knowledge of him just floors him. He says, "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me to understand." He's in awe that God knows him thoroughly. Yet if his first thought was wonder, his second thought would be escape. Which brings us to our second point, which is that God's presence represents a radical threat. You'll notice as you read through Psalm 139 that right around verse 6, there seems to be kind of a departure in tone. He says in verse 7, "I can never escape from your spirit. I can never get away from your presence. If I go up to heaven, you're still there. If I go down to the grave, you're there too." And so, David is sort of freaked out by God's presence in his life, which I kind of get. Now, some people think that David is speaking sort of rhetorically, that he's using this as a way to describe God's omnipresence. And yet, that word there in verse 7, escape, sometimes translated flee, is the same word that the book of Jonah uses in Jonah 1 verse 3 to describe Jonah trying to flee from the Lord. And so I take it as David describing flight from exposure. He says in verse 9 and 10, he says, "If I ride on the wings of the morning or the dawn, or if I even dwell by the farthest oceans, even there your hand will guide me and strengthen and support me." Now, the dawn is the east. And from the standpoint where David is writing this, the west represents the sea, the Mediterranean Ocean. So he's saying, even if I run as far east as I can or sail as far west as I can, there's no way that I can run away from you. Your presence is there. I can't escape it. The NET translation, again, I think, captures this pretty well. It says, "If I were to fly away on the wings of the dawn and settle down on the other side of the sea, you would be there." And so, this exposure that David is experiencing leads him to flight. Finally, in verse 11 through 12, he says, "I could ask the darkness to hide me and the light around me to become night, but even in darkness I can't hide from you. To you the night shines as bright as the day. Darkness and light are the same to you." Even though David couldn't escape God geographically, it doesn't matter if he tries to do things under the cover of night, because God has created both night and day. They're alike to him. And so there's really nowhere for him to escape. No matter where he runs, God is at every turn. And I can relate to this. I don't know if you have had this feeling where, you know, you're exposed for something in your life, some sort of sin that you've been holding back, and the first thing that you want to do is run, is to get away. And I think that that's what David is describing here. And so God's presence represents a radical threat, first of all, because his presence actually threatens our freedom. God's presence encroaches upon us. It hems us in. It makes us feel uncomfortable. Jean Paul Sartre, in his 1947 lecture on existentialism, I think captured this perfectly, where he says, "The existentialist finds it extremely embarrassing that God does not exist, for there disappears with him all possibility of finding values of good a priori. It is nowhere written that the good exists, that one must be honest or must not lie, since we are now upon the plane where there are only men." Dostoevsky once wrote, "If God does not exist, everything would be permitted." And that, for existentialism, is the starting point. He says, however, man is in consequence forlorn, for he cannot find anything to depend on, upon either within or outside of himself. In other words, man is free. Man is freedom. This is what I mean when I say that man is condemned to be free. Did you catch that last part? Condemned to be free. On the one hand, we want to be free. But on the other hand, we understand that what comes with that freedom is no hand, no guidance. And so we're stuck, really, in that tension, where we don't want to have anything to do with God in our lives. We want to direct our own paths. And yet we feel that crushing weight of responsibility to guide our own lives. I believe that that was the tension that David felt as he was writing this psalm. As he was thinking about God's active presence in his life, he wanted to escape. He wanted to avoid being hemmed in, and yet he also longed for the guidance that God provided. I think, secondly, God's presence threatens to expose us. In a recent study, I've been doing some work on how social media is actually affecting our culture. A recent Pew survey came out that shows that most people in our culture, as they are posting content on social media, actually try to curate content that either puts them in a good light or edits it so it hides their blemishes. And I think, really that is at the heart of our society, our culture, where we want to try to manage our image to people. We're afraid of being exposed. We're afraid of people finding out what we're really like. That scares us. You know, on the one hand, we really want people to love us. We want people to accept us for who we really are. Yet on the other hand, we're deathly afraid that if people find us out for who we really are, that they'll reject us. And yet, God knows everything about us. You know, imagine you had a thought teleprompter that you were walking around with. You know what a teleprompter is? It's that mechanism that people look into, typically reporters on TV. Here's Obama with one. Now, imagine if you had a thought teleprompter that broadcasted every single thought that you had in your head, visible to all the people around you. Do you think you'd be able to hold down a job? You know, your boss walks into the office, says, "Hey, can you stay late tonight? Only if you want me to kill you." Excuse me, what'd you say? Oh, nothing, nothing. Do you think you'd ever be able to hold a successful dating relationship or marriage? Honey, how do you think my new haircut looks? Does it look good? I would say yes if I wanted to marry Justin Bieber. Do I look fat in this dress? Absolutely. Most of us maintain our relationships precisely because we hold back our thoughts, right? And yet God knows all the thoughts we have, every one of them. And I think that scares us. We're afraid to be exposed for who we are. And yet, I think that when we're exposed, that represents really kind of a turning point in our relationship with God, where we're pushed to the brink of either flight, like David was feeling, or that it actually can draw us closer to Him in deeper intimacy. Think about Jesus' interaction with the woman at the well. As He's having this conversation with this woman, what is the turning point of the conversation? When Jesus says, go get your husband. And she's like, what? I don't have a husband. He's like, you're right. Because you have five, and the one that you're living with right now, he's not your husband. And you could tell at that point, something happened. Something snapped. Jesus exposing her for her sin broke up the hardness of her heart. And it was at that moment when she asked Jesus, we'll figure out all these things when the Messiah comes. And He responds, I am He. And at that moment, she just drops her jug and runs into town. And so it's when we are exposed for who we are in front of God that it actually draws us closer into intimacy with Him. You know, when God's presence exposes us, we're either on that brink of intimacy or flight. And you know, one of the real amazing things about this, I think, is that, you know, God, even though He knows everything about us, every thought that we have, everything that we've ever done in secret, every motive that we have, God knows all of those things, and yet He still accepts us. That's the amazing thing. That God, billions of years ago, probably, decided that when He looked at the body of work of our lives, all the things that we would ever do, that even though we did all of those things, He still committed to send His Son to die for us. That He still loved us. And I think that that really solves the tension that we feel. On the one hand, wanting to be loved, wanting to be accepted fully, and yet being afraid of being exposed. That God knows us on the one hand and still accepts us for who we are. More than that, God refuses to see our sin and instead looks at our new identity in Christ. Think about what He says in Colossians 1:22. He has brought you into His own presence, and you are holy and blameless as you stand before Him without a single fault. Can you believe that God, knowing everything that you have thought, even just today, could declare that about you? That He could declare that about me? I mean, that is just jaw-dropping that He could declare us that way. Well, in David's case, being exposed brought him to a deeper level of intimacy, which we're going to look at here in the remaining verses. Verse 13, he says, "You made all the delicate inner parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb." What a beautiful picture. God hand wrought you in your mother's womb. In verse 14, he says, "Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it." And so David finally comes to a place of thanksgiving. He realizes that the reason why God knows him so well is because God created him specifically the way he is. That he designed him. Now, in other translations, verse 14 says, "I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made." I've always been confused about what that "fearfully" part actually means. That word "fearfully" also is the word "amazing." If you look that up in the theological workbook of the Old Testament, that word can mean amazing or amazingly. And so I think that what David is saying is, "I praise you, I thank you, for I am awesomely and wonderfully made." He is in total awe of what God has done in creating him. You know, when I was, when we sometimes look at ourselves, I think we struggle with feeling like we have a lot of flaws, we have a lot of deficiencies. Some of us struggle with feeling like, we're worthless, or sometimes we wish that we are as gifted as other people. And I think it's tough for us where we struggle with a negative self-image. And yet, God says that he has made you like an artist who's created a masterpiece. He's created you. And he's not just talking about, that human beings are incredibly complex on a scientific level, but that all of our characteristics, like our gifting, our personality traits, our drives, that God has set that in a harmonious balance so that what seems to be missing or what seems to be a deficit may be actually part of the whole picture of what God has created you to be. When I was in college, I took an interest in art history. And of the Renaissance artists, the four big ones, as they were known, were Raphael, Michelangelo, Leonardo, and Donatello. Today, they're just referred to as the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, right? Now, Raphael learn from Michelangelo and Leonardo. You know, Michelangelo was known for how he was able to demonstrate movement, not only in his paintings, but also in his sculptures. And Leonardo was actually known for this style of painting where he would blur the image so it would create this softness of the figure. And Raphael actually incorporated both of those things, but what he was actually known for was composition, which if you're not really familiar with art, it's how you arrange your canvas or whatever it is that you're painting. And so, for example, this is one of his famous paintings, The Triumph of Galatia. It's a fresco. And if you look at it, the boy at the bottom of the chariot is balanced by the boy at the very top. The figures on the right are echoed by those on the left. And so there is this perfect balance. One of the things that's incredible about Raphael was sort of the simplicity and the effortlessness that he was able to paint these paintings. And one of the things that's incredible about it really is that there's not a lot of clutter in his paintings. That his canvas has a lot of room to breathe. And yet, that effortlessness that Raphael was able to bring to his paintings wasn't haphazard at all. For example, in this other painting, which he was known for, doing a lot of different Madonnas with Child paintings, he actually created four different sketches of it before he actually painted it. And so all of this was planned perfectly. He designed it. He composed it thoughtfully. Likewise, you know, when you look at things that you regard as being a deficit or something that's really missing in your life that you wish you had more of, or when you envy somebody else's gifting, or when you wish that you had more drive like this other person and you don't, essentially, you're not critiquing yourself, you're critiquing God and His craftsmanship. That's like going up to one of Raphael's paintings and saying, I could do better than that. This guy thinks he's kidding. He's a total hack. That's like critiquing a master. And so, you know, one of the reasons maybe why God hasn't given you a particular gifting is because He knows the kind of blended gifting that He's going to create through your home group or through the people that He would surround you with. Well, he says in verse 15 and 16, he says, you watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, and I was woven together in the dark of the womb. You saw me before I was even born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before even a single day passed. So David moves from the womb to his actual life outside of the womb and says, every day was laid out before I even existed. You knew what was going to happen to me. You knew all the things that would come into my life, all the suffering, all the tragedy, all of the difficult circumstances that I would encounter in life. You laid those all out in advance. You knew what I could handle. He says in verse 17 and 18, he says, how precious are your thoughts about me, O God? They can't even be numbered. I can't even count them. They outnumber the grains of sand. And when I wake up, you're still with me. That's jaw-dropping. Think about that. There is somebody who exists that thinks about you more than you think about yourself. Amazing. And yet God's thoughts about you as an individual are so vast. They can't even be counted. Who are the people that you're drawn to? Aren't they the people that when you spend time with them, they have thought about you, they've prayed for you, they've reflected on your life? They're the ones who often give you the most insight about your life. Those are the people that you want to spend time with, right? And so God's intimate knowledge of us, His active presence in our lives, actually draws us closer to Him. That knowledge of His presence makes us want to be closer to Him. Finally, in verse 23 and 24, he says, search me, O God, and know my heart. And so David invites God to come into his life, to scour him, to scan his heart. You know, this really mirrors verse 1. The thesis of this psalm where he says, O Lord, you have examined my heart and you know everything about me. From there he concludes, because of God's goodness, that he can call upon God to examine him, to search his heart. He says, test me and know my anxious thoughts. Maybe David recognized that his concerns and worries were leading him into sin. Maybe he saw the connection between those things. And so he says, test me. Reveal to me whether or not I have these anxious thoughts. David understands that his heart is deceitful and that there are things lurking underneath the surface. In Psalm 19, verse 12, he says, how can I know all the sins lurking in my heart? He realizes that, like most people, he's probably the last one to see his own problem that is blatantly obvious to everyone around him. Finally, he says, point out anything in me that offends you and lead me along the path of life everlasting. So he not only asks for wisdom and insight about his problems, but he also asks for God's guidance toward a life of sanctification. Now, I think this is very interesting because some of us are probably stuck in this place where we're constantly evaluating ourselves, we're taking inventory of our sin, we're feeling bad about ourselves constantly. And yet, I'm not sure how much good that does. You know, I go through these bouts probably every 2 years or so where I just start feeling really bad about myself. I encounter a lot of self-doubt. I start believing in these lies that, you know, I really don't play an important role here, that I'm just sort of a placeholder. I'm sure anyone could replace me, or that I'm not making a significant contribution like I should be in this ministry. Just recently, this winter, I was talking to a brother and I was struck by how self-aware he was about his own sin problems. And it got me to thinking, you know, I never really think too much about my weaknesses at all. And I was like, that could be a major problem. You know how it is when you're hanging out with somebody and everybody in the room knows that this person has this problem. And they just happen to be the only one in that room who doesn't know that they have that problem. And it made me wonder, I wonder if I'm that guy. And so I started asking around, you know, to my friends, like, you know, is there something like in my character or judgment errors that I've made recently that you've just sort of wondered about? And nobody brought up anything significant. And after about 2 or 3 weeks of this, it didn't really yield too many results. Meanwhile, I found myself being real tentative as I would step out to serve or teach. I was constantly second-guessing myself. I was being indecisive. I was thinking about myself a lot, feeling depressed. And finally, I just decided, you know what, this is worthless. This is a worthless project. Because if I look back on my history, the times where God has exposed problems in my life, it wasn't because I was looking for that. It's because He sent somebody into my life to show me that there was a problem. And so we can be confident that when we turn to God, knowing that He understands us completely, and He knows when the best time is to bring up problems in our life, that we could simply turn to Him and say, search me, O God. Show me if there's something wrong. I'm open to that. But meanwhile, we can step out in confidence to serve Him. You know, the Christian life shouldn't be characterized by morose self-reflection and constant second-guessing of our decisions. It should be characterized by confidence in the Lord and victory. Is that the way your Christian life is characterized? And so, I think we should call out to God. Turn to Him and ask Him if there's something there. And just leave it at that. Trust that God is going to communicate that to you if that's a problem. Now, there are some of us who do need to second guess ourselves a little bit more. You may not know it, but your co-leaders are thinking it. I think all of us should ask God to search us out and give us wisdom about maybe glaring problems in our life, but we need to pray in faith, not as the double-minded that James talks about who pray but refuse to really listen to God.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.